Hi, I'm Jason DeRosso. Welcome to The Final Cut, RN's weekly show dedicated to film. And this week is a special edition of the show, a critics roundtable dedicated to the Sydney Film Festival, which is in its last days. It ends on Sunday. And I'm joined this week in the studio by some esteemed colleagues, Connor Bateman, managing editor of 4.3, an online film journal. Hi, Connor.
Hi, Jason.
Jane Mills, film scholar from the University of New South Wales and also series editor of Australian Screen Classics. Hi, Jane.
Good to be here.
And hello to you, Luke Goodsell, an esteemed critic who's written for 4.3, online journal, Empire, and former editor of Rotten Tomatoes, which I find one of your more interesting credits.
Kindly don't hold that against me. thanks for having us.
Well, let's get to a film that I think is one of the strongest in competition at the Sydney Film Festival this year. And I know you all agree. And so I thought we'd just begin by talking about what makes it so great. And it's Certain Women by Kelly Reichardt, this fascinating minor key character study in three discrete or semi-discrete episodes, because there are suggestions amongst the different stories of linkages or semi-linkages. Connor Bateman, I know you were really impressed by this film. What did you think of it?
I do think Certain Women is the strongest film in the competition. I think it's fascinating to see Reichardt move back to the slower, more contemplative cinema of Old Joy and win in Lucy after her thriller Night Moves a few years back at the festival. I think she's working in this fascinating mode in Certain Women that is almost the short story film. Very few filmmakers in America seem to do it. It's a lot more in kind with maybe Hong Sang-soo in Korea, in which you've got these discrete separate stories, as you said, that do link in some way, but that's not the point. It's more about atmosphere and character and creating a sense of tone that reverberates throughout.
Actually, moving on from there, I'm just thinking that the Almodovar film this year, Julieta, that's actually based on three short stories as well. So maybe there's something in the air about short stories that's coming into cinema, which is good. But I have to say, I totally agree that for me, this is the strongest film. And it's good to see a filmmaker like build on her strengths, but also move forward. I mean, in a very good way. The last segment of the three sections has got this. She's not a total newcomer, but a young actress called Lily Gladstone. And while Michelle Williams is terrific, Laura Dern, with whom I've been in love for years and years and years, is also terrific. But Lily Gladstone took my breath away. She plays a young, I think it's understated, but I think she plays a young Native American woman. And it's where Kelly Reichardt really goes into slow cinema, slow movies, which often do have animals in them, funnily enough. And there is a horse, and there's a moment in this film.
She's a stable hand, right?
She's a stable hand, that's right. And there's a moment in this where Kristen Stewart and Lily Gladstone and a horse, I think it's the most magical moment of the whole festival for me.
It's this film of, it's this moment in the film that's, it's an extended riff on learning, yearning and learning, oddly, because Kristen Stewart plays a night school teacher. What did you think of that particular episode in the film more generally, Luke?
That was my favorite episode in the film, but I mean, overall, the film is very, very strong. And as Connor said, it's interesting to see Reichardt go back to the more contemplative mode after sort of dabbling in thriller with Night Moves, her previous film, which I did really like also. This one is, again, it's sort of her sense of space and emptiness, and also a evocation of time is really impressive.
How good is her depiction of this mid-northwestern America as well, small town America, this, that kind of it.
It's Montana, isn't it?
Apparently it's Montana.
It felt very Canada to me. I don't know if it did to the others, and maybe, I don't know why it should, but it felt sort of cold, on the edges of something.
Absolutely. Well, it does seem like it's at the foot of mountains. Mm. It's on the edge of snow, but the snow is never really foregrounded. And the way she shoots the landscape in the reflections as well was something that I know was an observation everyone was pinging around Twitter after they saw the film. It's just magical.
I think surprisingly, it might actually be the best shot film of the festival as well. And we're talking about reflections. It happens a lot in the films of this festival. You have reflections on windows, as you did in The Childhood of a Leader, used windows a lot. But Certain Women, every shot means something. Every shot's really well composed. And the way in which she plays with framing and time, as you were saying, Luke, the sense of time in the film is quite magical. Mm. Yeah. It just so seamlessly moves from, you know, week to week without any marker.
Yeah, I mean, I love that first setup between Laura Dern, who's this small town lawyer, having an affair with a married guy. Just that setup of him having a shower, her being in bed, and clearly there's a sense of, I mean, it sounds a bit film schoolish to describe it, but clearly they're separated in frame and you get a sense that all is not well in this relationship.
And she holds that camera. I mean, that's what, one of the markers, I guess, of slow cinema, which I think probably it's better to call it contemplative.
Because yeah.
you look at the screen in a different way and holding that camera, and you look at the edges of the screen. Your eyes aren't just drawn to the center. And I think you said that there's an edginess there. And there are lots and lots of, I mean, Unrequited Love, which we see in the third episode, that's about love on the edge of things. And everyone's on the edge of breaking up or the edge of breaking into tears. Or it's incredibly moving, but not the slightest bit of sentimentality.
No, it's a very emotionally sort of angular film. Something that strikes me, though, about this film being so good is that it reminded me when I was preparing for this how many of the films that are great in the festival and that I've loved are about women and or by women.
Mm.
And that seems to me to be something that's more pronounced this year than other years.
It's so strong, yeah. I mean, I read somewhere that last year, of the 250 top-selling all-time best movies of last year, only 7% were made by women. Now, you would not, like, figure that if you see the credits of the most of the films in the festival this year. And it's kind of by accident. I mean, they do have a special section for European women filmmakers.
That's true.
But I just chose the films that I wanted to go to. I tend to try and choose films that haven't got distribution because I won't get to see them otherwise. And almost by accident, I found that all the ones I'd chosen, or most of the ones I'd chosen, were by women. They're very strong. They're very and original and new and different, exciting.
I do think, I totally agree. As it turns out, the three best films I've seen all festival were written and directed by women, which were Certain Women, Chevalier by Athena Rachel Sangari, and Tony Erdmann by Maren Arda.
Yeah, so, which is Tony Erdmann, hot off the press from Cannes, a late inclusion.
Yeah,
no doubt people will be able to see it in Melbourne too.
I would tend to agree. I mean, I know we're going to possibly touch on this a bit later, but my favorite film of the festival by far is Chantal Ackerman's No Home movie.
Yeah.
Which I think is just, as you described it, like a final masterwork.
Yeah, oh,
and
absolutely.
An incredible film.
Absolutely.
And just so happens, I mean, you know, of women directors, like the women director, I guess. Well, certainly one of the most influential of the past 40 years.
I concur with that, absolutely. Mm. I mean, Chantal Ackerman, she committed suicide late last year, and seeing her last film, knowing that she was going to die, it was quite extraordinary, very powerful. Mm.
Well, let's talk about that film now, because I was also just struck by, I mean, I'd heard the mixed reviews about the film.
Apparently before got she'd booed, committed, is that right?
I'd heard this.
Yeah.
I think that's unfounded, though.
It's the alleged, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, it's alleged. I hope so.
I was expecting something, you know, uneven, I guess. And I think formally it's a perfect film.
It's absolutely a perfect film.
It's a film about the last months of her mother's life.
Hmm.
And we get a real sense of how important her mother is to her. We get that sense already knowing her work, obviously, because her mother and mothers feature quite prominently in her work. But you get a sense of her mother also taking her mother's health taking a turn for the worse. And I love how about midway through, this very simple digital cinematography becomes so inventive. She goes from exposing her shots to be adjusted for the light inside the apartment to exposing her shots to be adjusted for the light outside, so that everything in the apartment looks shadowy suddenly in the last sort of third of the film. She does things like that, which I think are just so expressive and remarkable.
Mm. I saw one review, which really made me quite cross, because I think whoever wrote this got it really wrong, but they said that it was a tragic statement on the futility of life, which is such a cliche, I guess, anyway. But I really think that No Home movie, Chantal Ackerman's film, is about love and the complications of love. I mean, love isn't easy. Love for one's mother is definitely not easy, and there's another film maybe that we can talk about that. But this daughter's relationship with her mother, there is one shot, actually, where we see them talking to each other on Skype. So we see a sort of pixelated picture picture of the mother who's in Brussels and Chantal Ackerman's, I think, in New York. And you see then Chantal Ackerman, the daughter's shadow or reflection on the screen, so laid on top of the mother. We know the mother died. We know Chantal Ackerman died. And somehow she brings like past, present and future all into one shot in that way. I mean, it looks simple. It's not simple.
She's like Kelly Reichardt, or Kelly Reichardt like Ackerman, really. But, you know, another master of the frame, huh? Because the frame. There's not a lot of movement in her frames. It's a very, you know, modestly made film. But the frames are great. And the way that she shoots through the corridors of the house of her mother and always places the camera sort of almost at waist height, which seems to just...
It's almost a, but it's, I mean, I remember those shots too, and it's almost as if it's a, Chantal is a little girl again, and she's observing her mother's apartment. There's something, I mean, I don't often say this, but that was actually a very devastating film to see, and especially in light of, you know, News from Home, her 1977 documentary, which is all about her relationship via, you know,
letters.
Mail, yeah, with her mother. This film is very sort of complementary to that, and that's also a very sort of touching sort of expression of the relationship between mother and daughter, which I think is reinforced in this. And again, as you say, Jane, that just you can't help but watch this film without the knowledge of, you know, Chantal actually having committed suicide, and I think that adds an extra layer of, you know, it's not tragedy, but just sort of deepens the impact, and there's a real sense of... her statelessness, I think. I mean, the movie is called Know Her Movie, which pertains to her and also her mother. But yeah, there's a real sort of sense of her
mother as a Jew, and the Jewish identity is very much at the forefront of their discussions.
But it also sort of extends to her in the sense that she's, I mean, her movies are often about, like, you know, figures living out of hotel rooms. And there's a sense that almost her life was lived with, you know, the camera and the Skype and so there's a sense of homecoming, but to what, I guess?
That's right. I mean, that those issues of home, exile, memory, loss, that we know refugees, asylum seekers, people who are forced to move from one place to another. But there is a feeling that somehow that relationship with her mother both pushed Chantal away, but also constantly draws her back. So she goes in and out of frame and keeps the camera more or less constantly still, which... Once again, I mean, it's rather like the Kelly Reichardt film. You know, you look at the screen in a different way. The framing is, as you say, Jason, you look towards the edges. You put yourself into it. I think it's actually welcoming us to, as audience, to engage with it.
On our end, you're listening to The Final Cut and a special roundtable film critics discussion on the Sydney Film Festival. Let's talk about a very different film, but something that fits within the theme of the discussion so far, because it's a film by a female filmmaker, but it's about men, only about men, on a boat, on a luxury yacht, I suppose you'd call it.
And it's very funny.
And it's quite funny. It's called Chevalier. And it sounds like a big jump, but in some ways there is also a very rigorous framing going on in the film, I think. Conor Bateman, what did you think of it? What struck you about it?
I think Chevalier is, an absolutely hilarious film. It's a very strange follow-up to Attenberg from Sangari, which was about a young girl trying to find her place in the world as her father is dying, but framed as a very strange comedy. This is just an absurd satire on the state of, you know, masculinity and male dominance in which...
And competitiveness.
And competitiveness. In which I think it's seven men are on a luxury boat off the coast of Greece, and then
the boat is broken down essentially, which prompts the competition.
Yeah, and they are all playing card games, they're all playing guessing games, and then one of them says that there can't be a way to decide who's the best in general, and in which their response is to create a game in which you can decide who the best man in general is, which involves them judging each other on how they sleep, on how they eat, on whether they smoke or not.
And what I loved about this, I mean, this is co-written and directed by Athena Rachel Sangari, who's one of the leading lights, I suppose, of what's loosely called, well, it's sort of Greece's new parallel cinema. It's been called the Greek weird wave and so forth. But what I love about it is that the male gaze is reflected back inwards, and it's like men really carefully and critically looking at each other Including watching other men while they sleep to see if they wake up with erections, I think, at one point, or seeing what men wear to bed,
and
if they drool on their pillow. It's quite. I also love the very droll moments of those announcements on the PA. They're very banal, but they come across as also very sinister.
Προσοχή παρακαλώ. Ενημερώνουμε ότι στο απόψινο μενού το cheesecake αντικαταστάθηκε από lemon pie. Ευχαριστούμε πολύ και συγγνώμη για την οποιαδήποτε αναστάτωση.
Now, I'm not quite sure what that one was.
It's a bit Big Brothery, isn't it?
But their announcement's like, you know, there won't be cheesecake tonight for dessert. There'll be lemon pie instead.
Well, we apologise. It fits in fascinating with Yorgos Lanthimos's The Lobster last year, which also had similar announcements in their, you know, dystopic hotel.
I think it's an homage to that, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was great. The one character in it who I really, really kind of fell for this festival, because I saw him in another film called Suntan, but that's Makis Papadimitriou. And he's the kind of rather chubby chap who maybe he's a little autistic, but he likes numbers and he likes playing kind of games with his hands. And he's not up there. We know he's not going to win. And there is, a scene, I won't give it away, but he does a scene to music. And
I was about to give that away, but yeah. Very good.
but I think I've never been, well, this festival, that was the scene where everybody in the cinema just fell about laughing. Mm. And it's... I mean, the good thing, although it is about masculinity and competitiveness, and it's from a woman who is, I think, clearly a feminist, it also has affection for the ridiculousness. Maybe it does. Maybe some men don't find that so affectionate. But I found that there was some affection there.
Do you guys find that affectionate?
I think it's a very, like, it is a very, you know, pointed satire of the absurdity of male one-upmanship, but it's done with a lot of humour. And I think she likes these characters to a large extent. Yeah. I mean, as the musical scene says, I mean, it's kind of a deflating moment, but it's also very funny.
But I tell you, what's there not to like? I mean, I was just watching this thinking, these are such great character actors here. And I was wondering, sure. I mean, you could easily imagine it translated into different cultures. There's probably a version of this in it. But I was kind of scratching my head and wondering, well, who would you get? Could you assemble as good an ensemble in Australia, for example, to do that? And I don't know that you could. Do you know what I mean? I mean, just think she's assembled such a great group of actors.
Interestingly, you say that in this same festival, Richard Linklater's Everybody Wants Some, about a team of baseball players in the off-season who are competing with each other in a house that involves knuckles games, that involves who can sleep with the most women, that involves this, is a similar take on, well, not a similar take, a different take on the same subject matter. And interestingly, because Linklater and Sangari have a filmmaking history together with Before Midnight and Slacker. So I think there is some translation to that, but I think you are right, the sensibility that Chevalier brings is quite singular.
Thanks for pointing that out. I really want to see them in a double bill.
That is a very interesting point, actually. But also I think the Western performers, for lack of a better description, would require a certain lack of self-consciousness that these character actors have in this film. So if you imagine, say, the Hollywood remake, like which actors would be willing to subject themselves to, you know, being watched by other men and being emasculated in such, you know, hilarious ways.
Do you remember that advertisement on television? It was for, like, don't speed. If you're a man and you've got a fast car, don't go fast. And it ends up with a woman sort of looking ridiculing
that's,
at them.
That's
with, and waving his little finger. There's a lot of that in this film.
Okay, well, that seems like as good a point as any to introduce the Queen track, which features prominently in a Brazilian film called Aquarius, which is also in competition. And I think it also has a pretty good chance of winning the award, the City Film Prize for Audacious Filmmaking. Stars Sonia Braga. It's about a woman who is the last in her sort of historic beachside block of flats to go. Well, everyone else has been bought out by these developers who want to build this new skyscraper called Aquarius, and she doesn't want to sell up. And you don't blame her because it's a nice place, but the film becomes this really interesting sort of war, the depiction of this war between her and these developers, which I think reflects on Brazilian society in all sorts of interesting ways. I mean, it's about the anti-intellectualism, a sort of rampant anti-intellectualism that's part of modern Brazilian capitalism. It's about a woman who represents a certain generation of activists and a certain generation who thought about politics in a certain way that is now coming up against the new generation that aren't ideological, or if they are ideological, they sort of only care about money and so forth. Did you guys think it was strong as well?
So Jason, I haven't seen it, and I really am cross that I missed it. It just clashed with everything else, and that is such his life. But is it about class as well? Because his last film that I really loved, Neighbouring Sounds, that had a very, I thought, interesting take on sort of lower middle class, yep, and upward mobility and downward mobility.
Well, I think that's what's interesting about it. I think it is about class. And what's interesting about him, Kleiber Mendoza Filho, who's the director of Aquarius, is that he looks at the middle class in Brazil, which is not an easy, it's not an easy class to look at, because they're not instantly sort of likable necessarily. I mean, we tend to empathize with the favela dwellers, and you know, which are much easier to sort of represent on screen because we know that they're the good guys, right? But here she is in part implicit.
She's stuck, isn't she?
She's not stuck.
Oh,
no,
that's good.
She just wants to stay, and she wants to resist these developers. But
she would be, I guess, termed upper middle class because she's the widow of a very successful musician, and I mean, it's a beachfront property. It's an older place, but it's also a great location, and she's, as you say, she's not from a favela, so she's not the one you automatically root for or identify with. And I think that's part of the film's quite impressive feat, is that it does develop this very interesting character out of this upper middle class woman who, and it's almost like the developers who are trying to kick her out, you get the sense that maybe perhaps this guy came from more of a working class situation.
Well, I don't know, because a lot's made of the fact that she's got darker skin. So there is a lot, and right, sometimes that's used against her, that she's condescended to when people sort of say, oh, well, we know how hard it must have been for a woman of your skin colour to sort of live this well and achieve this sort of lifestyle, and she won't be sort of patronised, but people try to. So there are lots of sort of paradoxes about her situation. She's middle class, but she's left wing. She's sort of from a mixed race background, but she sort of transcended the racism
she
of the society.
She collects vinyl, but advocates streaming as well. So
well, it's quite
you're
a
right.
complex film in that way, actually. As another critic, James Durante, put it, she's almost fighting for a right to live in affluence.
Yeah.
In the film, it is the politics are fascinating because it is, as you say, look, upper middle class. It is the refusal to move, and that's all tied up as well into this idea of generational in how we engage with art, in how we engage with family. There's a heartbreaking scene in the middle of the film where she's having an argument with her daughter, and the daughter brings up her 2-year absence from their family when they were young, and the girl's brother goes to the bookshelf, pulls down Sonia Braga's book, opens it, and there's a message that's like, sorry for the
dedication to
my children, sorry for the years
wonderful.
That you were stolen.
Look, it's wonderful, and I love his use of dissolves and zooms, especially early on in the film, which really starts to give a sense of how the past and the present are layered, and we get a sense of memories. And he's got a wonderful, he has this wonderful sense of, I mean, we've talked about apartment films, I think, a lot, and certainly filmmakers today that are good with the built environment.
And small enclosed spaces.
Yeah, like Kelly Reichardt's films like that.
Like No Home Movie.
No Home Movie, yes. Absolutely. It's an apartment film. And this film's set in a real apartment, and it's wonderfully photographed. But also he has this way of sort of, he'll zoom and track in on a piece of furniture, and suddenly that'll be a cue for some erotic backstory, a love scene or something, and an incredibly sort of outrageous love scene.
And Sonia Braga, who plays the main character, I mean, I guess listeners might remember her in Kiss of the Spider Woman.
That's right.
I mean, many
two
other
loves of Donna Flores.
Well, she is fantastic.
She's wonderful in this.
Is she great?
She's great.
Yeah.
A cancer survivor too, so there's another aspect to it. She's not easy to sort of pigeonhole, this woman, which I like a lot about this
film. And the film is difficult to pigeonhole also for its complexity, I think.
Well, that's all the time we've got today on The Final Cut. I've really enjoyed, though, having you all in to discuss our favourite films. Before we go, just a film from each of you. Just name check one film that you've also been impressed by. First to you, Luke Goodsell.
I would have to say In Jackson Heights, which is the latest documentary by the great documentarian Frederick Wiseman.
Connor?
I was really taken by Danis Tanovich's Death in Sarajevo.
And I really, really like Baxter and Me, local filmmaker Jill Lay. And she looks back at her history. She was a feminist. That made her happy. She had lots of unhappy love affairs. And finally, she's an older woman. She loves her dogs. She loves her life. And it's a lovely film.
All right. Well, on that note, thank you to all of you. Jane Mills, film scholar from the University of New South Wales, Connor Bateman, managing editor of 4/3 online film journal, and Luke Goodsell, a critic for various publications, but you can read his work on 4/3 Empire as well.
Thank you.
That's it from me. I'm Jason DeRosso. I'll see you next week on The Final Cut.